So what I learned from that was I've got to learn their language. I've got to be able to speak in a way that they can understand that what I'm doing is really no different than what they do conceptually, right? So I don't claim to be a doctor, but what I started looking at was that the work that we do in continuous improvement is very much like a doctor-patient relationship, with the organization being our patient. And so we go in, and the first thing that we do is we go in and we find out where's your pain, what's your wellness goal that you're trying to achieve, and let's start working from there. And we have to establish a relationship first, so there's a trust factor that has to be involved. So establish that relationship, talk about problems, talk about pain, talk about wellness goals, and then look at the vital signs. What are the metrics that you're tracking that let you know that you're not where you want to be? And then we do a history and physical. What have you done in the past that's worked well? What are you willing to do? What are you not willing to do? And then we do a diagnosis. That's the problem solving, where we get to the root cause. And rather than treating symptoms, we look for the root cause and try and figure out, what are the countermeasures or what's the plan of care that we're going to put into place in order to try and improve the organization. And then finally, we'll schedule a follow-up appointment. And using PDCA, if things are working, great. If they're not, let's make some adjustments and we'll continue on. And so that to me was what a business review, a monthly business review was, is that we see how we're doing. We make some adjustments, we implement things, we come back a month later and see, did it work or not? And then let's make some adjustments. And so that was what really helped me to make that transition from some of the business speak or MBA speak or whatever to, all right, I need to understand how do healthcare workers actually think.
Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a higher performance organization, with your host, Joseph Paris.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat between me, your host, Joseph Paris, and a select industry leader. Today, that industry leader is Tim Petrie, Program Director of Continuous Improvement at the Cleveland Clinic, and has been a member of Continuous Improvement there since 2008. The Continuous Improvement Program and its team of experts supports over 70,000 Cleveland Clinic caregivers worldwide. Prior to jumping into the healthcare field, Tim spent 18 years with the Ford Motor Company at their Cleveland manufacturing site, which helped to design and deploy what would become the Ford Production System. Tim's passion for continuous improvement work comes from participating in and leading several cultural transformation efforts while at Ford and at the Cleveland Clinic. The highlight of his career was helping to save Ford Cleveland's engine plant number one from closing in 2002. Tim was appointed to the Shingo Institute's Board of Examiners in 1996 after leading the team responsible for writing Cleveland Engine Plant No. 2's achievement report and coordinating the site visit that led to the plant being awarded the Shingo Prize for Excellence in Manufacturing. Welcome, Tim. Welcome to State of Readiness. Great to have you as a guest.
Great. It's good to be here, Joseph. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. You know, we've never met in person, I don't believe, but we've been connected on LinkedIn for long time.
Yeah.
We've had several conversations,
yeah,
and all of them very, very enriching as far as I'm concerned, because your journey has been fairly significant. I mean, you've done some pretty amazing things over it. So why don't we dial it back to the beginning? How did you get involved in continuous improvement?
Sure. So long story short, I was working for Ernst & Whinney, so I'm aging myself a little bit. I was working for Ernst & Whinney, and they merged with Arthur Young and moved everything to New York. The Ernst & Whinney's national office was in Cleveland, and I was working in their marketing department there. And when they moved to New York, they moved the department, but not the people. And so I was looking for a job. Ernst & Whinney was great in terms of helping me in that process. And my father-in-law worked at Ford at the time as a superintendent of maintenance. And he said, give me your resume. You never know what'll happen. And he was looking after protecting his daughter and making sure that I was able to support her and our family. And So I ended up getting an offer to interview for a cost analyst position, and I had no background in finance and no background in manufacturing. And I told them I was, you know, I work for an accounting firm, but I'm not an accountant. And they said, no, we're just looking for a good business person. And at the time I was finishing up my MBA. And so I said, well, I'll go in and I'll interview. And one of the things that you always hear about Ford is that it's a family, you know, it's like being part of a family when you're there. And so when I was on the interview, that came up several times about, you know, it's being like being a family. So I figured, okay, if they offer me the position, I'll take it. I'll fill a hole in my resume. I'll get some experience in manufacturing and some experience in finance. And then after a year, I'll look for my dream job. And 18 years later, I was still there. But what happened was about 6 months after I was there, one of the other cost analysts left the company, and we were starting a new engine program. And there's two engine plants on the site in Cleveland. And so I went to the controller and I said, you know, I'd love to be a part of something from the start. And, you know, I don't have anything to unlearn. So, you know, it'll be a good opportunity for me to be a part of something that you're trying to build. So he said, okay. And so I went over, and the fortunate thing was our plant manager at the time was Gifford Brown. And Gifford was one of the people who was responsible for helping get the Shingo Prize up and running, and actually was able to get funding from Ford to keep the Shingo Prize afloat in the early years, and was actually the chairman of the board of governors for a little while. And he wanted to put together what he was calling the Cleveland production system. And he hired some ex-Toyota Georgetown managers to come and help us build what we called the Cleveland production system. So I was working in finance as a cost analyst, but my boss at the time was responsible for doing a lot of the writing. And so I said, you know, I used to proofread a lot of proposals when I was working at Ernst & Whinney, and that was one of the things that we did. I'd love to proofread any of the things that you're doing. And that's how I got introduced to Lean and everything that was going on. And as a result of all of that, it kind of led to me spent 5 years in finance, but then moved into human resources as a trainer in Lean concepts. And the rest, they say, is history. We ended up applying for the Shingo Prize, and I was led the team that was responsible for writing the achievement report and then hosting the site visit. And when we won the prize, that's how I became a Shingo examiner. And so, yeah, it was an interesting ride.
So did you ever find your dream job?
Yeah, actually I did. I loved it at Ford. I was, you know, that 1 year turned into 18 years. But yeah, the dream job was actually following winning the Shingo Prize. I got the opportunity. At the time, I wasn't sure if it was punishment or reward, but I got the opportunity to go over to Plant One, which was a sister plant on the site. And they were going through some really difficult times in that plant. Most of the people who were there were ones who decided not to come to Plant 2 because Plant 2 was going to a team-based approach, had a modern operating agreement, and Plant 1 was still operating on seniority-based. No. So they didn't want to be a part of a team. The Cleveland production system actually morphed into the powertrain production system and then eventually into the modern day Ford production system. And so every plant was responsible for implementing the Ford production system. The plant had just lost an engine line. One of the engine lines was discontinued. And then the second engine line, the volumes were cut in half. And my job at the time was to go over and implement teams plant-wide, implement the Ford production system in a plant that had just adopted a new modern operating agreement. So they were having to go to a team-based approach. And oh, by the way, the plant was scheduled to close in 3 years, and everybody knew it. And so
this is so Plant One, right?
This is Plant One. And so I went over to meet with my UAW counterpart, who I was going to be working with, to try and put together this training plan and how we were going to do this. And our first meeting, we hit it off. Our thinking was, you know, along the same lines. And so we put together a plan working with the plant leadership and the UAW leadership to cut the production to 4-day schedule and use the 5th day for training. And so we had about 600 people working on the plant right then. And so we ended up having about 120 people a day going through this training program that we put together to teach the Cleveland or the Ford production system and all of the lean tools. Then what we did is actually we would teach a concept during the week. And then the next week or two, we would have people out on the floor working on implementing what we had taught them, those concepts. And so we did that for probably about 9 months of training, over 100,000 hours of classroom training, but then a lot of stuff out on the plant floor coaching.
Right.
And eventually we ended up getting checkpoint A for the Ford production system. Our coaches, when I first asked the coaches, the Ford production system coaches, if they would you know, be able to provide any help, they kind of laughed at me and said, well, your plant's closing. We've got these pilot plants in vehicle operations and other places that we're keeping us busy working there. So yeah, we don't have any help for you. I said, well, what's the minimum requirement then? And they said, well, you have to have 2 official coaching visits. I said, great. When we're ready, we'll call you. And all we ask is that you come down and see what we're doing. So the first coaching visit, they came down, we took them directly out to the floor and let the people on the floor tell their story. And we came back to a conference room and they said, you guys are really doing this. I said, well, yeah. And they said, no, you don't understand. We're struggling in these other plants because people, you know, are resistant to change. And I said, well, no, we're doing it and it's working. So they went back, told their bosses. Their bosses came down. We did the same type of thing. And we had this succession of higher level executives from Ford coming down to see what we were doing. Eventually, Jack Nasser at the time and the UAW president at the time came down and ended up getting us onto the negotiations list for the next round of negotiations. And the plant was ended up being awarded a new engine. So we kept the plant open, which was really great. We closed down, shut down for changeover for a couple of years to implement the new machinery, but we reopened, and right now plant one is going strong still. And the unfortunate thing is plant two has closed down. So the Shingo Prize plant has closed. And it's just a victim of the whole auto industry upheaval that might happen.
Right, right. That's amazing. That's an amazing story. You even had Nasser in there. Awesome. That's really awesome. And then you became, as a result of that, a Shingo examiner. Are you still a Shingo examiner?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, super.
Yeah.
But eventually, now you're at the Cleveland Clinic, which is healthcare.
Right.
And I can't imagine, you know, the patients being wheeled down the production line as they would in the automotive industry. So, you know, how did that leap come about? And how was your transition going from, you know, 18 years in automotive, discrete manufacturing, to healthcare, which is, we'll call it, you know, less, you know, there's a lot less standards in healthcare. When I say standards, it's like tack time. You can't have a tack time on a appendectomy, for instance, you know? So what was that whole transition like?
Sure. So first of all, it was, you know, my career ended at Ford in 2008 as the auto industry and the whole economy was going through the recession. And I had just, my last year at, well, last 2 years at Ford, my position in the human resources and training had been eliminated. And then I became a coach for the powertrain operations for the Ford production system. So my last year at Ford, I was actually still based in Cleveland, but I was traveling around and helping some of the other powertrain plants. And since I was the last person into that group when the cuts started coming in 2008. I was one of the first ones to be let go, but I knew about it. And we knew early on in January that the positions might be eliminated by the end of the year. And so actually I went to a Shingo conference in April, I believe, of 2008, and just let everybody there, all my friends know that, you know, hey, if you're aware of anything, let me know. I came back from that conference, and I don't know if it was just coincidence or if there was any connection at all to that, but I got a call from a recruiter asking if I'd be interested in interviewing with the Cleveland Clinic. And so at the time, I was thinking, absolutely. I said, I don't have to relocate. It's one of the best known healthcare systems in the world. Lean was really just starting to come into healthcare at the time. And so it was, represented an opportunity to be a part of something new and help build what we were doing in terms of lean and healthcare. Went through a series of interviews. I got called back probably 3 to 4 different times to talk to different people in on main campus. I talked to nursing director. I talked to the chief experience officer, which was a new thing at the clinic at the time. We were working. They were working through some budgeting issues and. Finally, my job was eliminated at Ford early July on a Tuesday, and Wednesday I got a call from the recruiter saying I had a tentative offer. So that tentative offer ended up going until September before I finally started. We had a small group at the time. There was, I think I was number 7 hired into the group, and most of the others had been there for a year or two at the most, and we started doing continuous improvement work, but it was mostly project based, and so the transition for me was kind of difficult. I had been I was a Shingo examiner. I had been I was a Shingo representative on the Lean Certification Oversight and Appeals Committee. So SME, AME, and Shingo had come together to put together a Lean Certification Program. And so I was appointed to be on the Oversight and Appeals Committee for that. So I was very much a proponent of Lean Certification, Shingo examiner. And when I came into the clinic, I was thought that was really what I was going to be focused on. And I was actually was more of a project manager, and I'm not the best of project managers. I'm not real good at that structured approach to, running a project. So I struggled that first year, learned that the pace of the work was a lot different. One of the things that we were responsible for at the time was to introduce what we were calling monthly business reviews, where we would go and work with the department work with them to review their performance on a monthly basis. Well, coming from manufacturing, we reviewed performance every day. We knew exactly how we were doing. We knew, what was going on and how it's going. And in healthcare at that time, this was before, healthcare reform and everything. There was a lot of, you got paid for what you did, regardless of whether it was justified or not. I mean, you got paid for what you did. And so, so it was not looked at as a business. And there was there's a lot of resistance to looking at healthcare as a business and using business tools to really help improve performance. And I remember early on, and this is one of the lessons learned, was I was going in to work with our neurovascular cerebrovascular chair. So I was working in the Neurological Institute, cerebrovascular chairman, world-renowned brain surgeon, dealing with strokes, and his administrator to introduce this concept of a business review. And they said, well, so this kickoff meeting is taking place. And they said, well, you're not going to use all these business buzzwords with me, are you? And I said, well, no, I don't intend to. Why? And they started firing off one after another, these business buzzwords. And if you ever heard Weird Al Yankovic's parody called Mission Statement?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that was kind of what it was like. I said, no, I don't intend to, but you know, if I do, stop me. So what I learned from that was I've got to learn their language. I've got to be able to speak in a way that they can understand that what I'm doing is really no different than what they do conceptually, right? So I don't claim to be a doctor, but what I started looking at was that the work that we do in continuous improvement is very much like a doctor-patient relationship, with the organization being our patient. And so we go in, and the first thing that we do is we go in and we find out, where's your pain, what's your wellness goal that you're trying to achieve, and let's start working from there. And we have to establish a relationship first, so there's a trust factor that has to be involved. So establish that relationship, talk about problems, talk about pain, talk about wellness goals, and then look at the vital signs. What are the metrics that you're tracking that let you know that you're not where you want to be? And then we do a history and physical. What have you done in the past that's worked well? What are you willing to do? What are you not willing to do? And then we do a diagnosis. That's the problem solving, where we get to the root cause. And rather than treating symptoms, we look for the root cause and try and figure out, you know, what are the countermeasures or what's the plan of care that we're going to put into place in order to try and improve the organization. And then finally, we'll schedule a follow-up appointment, and using PDCA, if things are working, great. If they're not, let's make some adjustments and we'll continue on. And so that to me was what a business review, a monthly business review was, is that we see how we're doing. We make some adjustments, we implement things, we come back a month later and see, did it work or not? And let's make some adjustments. And so that was what really helped me to make that transition from some of the business speak or MBA speak or whatever to, all right, I need to understand how do healthcare workers actually think. And what I found really is that the principles of Lean apply across all industry. The principles are still the same. The tools are still used them. It's different. So you mentioned tack time, right? So you don't think of healthcare and tack time in the same breath, but there is a tack time. There is, how many patients can we see? How much time in the day do we have? How long do the appointments have to last? You know, what you can use tack time a lot. And it's what's really interesting is that I do some book studies with people who are interested in getting their Lean certification. And one of the challenges there is that the books that are part of the Lean certification program are all manufacturing books. And so we do these book studies. I serve as a translator to say, okay, here's the concept that was presented in the book. Let's talk about it in terms of healthcare. How can we come up with an example, similar example in healthcare, just different terminology, different words, but same concept. So, mm-hmm. So what I found is that principles, tools are the same, but you need to be aware of the context in which you're using them.
I want to just reel it back a couple of things, because there's a few points that you mentioned I think are really critical. The first is about the syntax, the language that you used. Okay. I mention this often when I go into a conference or whatever it is, especially business people. And if I go to an industrial engineering or an OpEx conference or a Lean conference, of course, everybody's going to know the terminology, but the CEO doesn't want to learn Japanese. You know, if they don't already know what a Gemba is, a Gemba walk or a Kaizen event, they don't want to learn a new language. And in fact, I think sometimes continuous improvement people do themselves a disservice by almost putting up a barrier in communication between the patient and themselves, being the doctor, by injecting these this terminology that is foreign to the person with whom you're speaking. And I think, you know, that then comes down to culture. And I think it was Deming that said that, culture will eat strategy for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And Nothing can be further from the truth, especially with you. You're interfacing with the senior leaders of the organization, and they're not going to bother to learn a new language when they have words in their language to understand, that they would understand.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. I mean, it's challenging for us as lean people or business coming in and just trying to understand, you know, what is a CLABSI or a CLABSI, or, you know, you talk about all of these different medical terminology that we don't, you know, we struggle to understand and learn about, but we have to, in order to, and not the details, but, you know, the concept.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was interesting. You mentioned, you know, the leaders aren't willing to, you know, they're busy people.
Yeah. Right.
And I would much rather, you know, a physician, a surgeon be thinking about surgeries than thinking about, you know, how are his supplies and his, supply room, organized.
Right.
But what I do want to do is have them understand that if the people who are supporting them have those things organized in a way that is easy for them to get to and know when we're running short and be able to order things before we run out, that's going to help you in your job, because you're not going to run into these delays and things that will happen when you're trying to do your work. And so we try and support the people who support, you know, the physicians and what they do. But one of the interesting things is that, so I work at Akron General Hospital now. So Akron General became part of the Cleveland Clinic about 7-8 years ago. And I've been working at Akron General now for the last little over four years. And when I came down there to talk to the hospital president at the time, still there, just to meet him and talk to him about, you know, philosophies and was it a good match for me being there and supporting what he's wanting to do. He pulled out a report off of his bookshelf behind him. He had been the hospital president at our Hillcrest Hospital, which is one of our larger suburban hospitals. And while he was there, Hillcrest Hospital was one of the first regional hospital that we started introducing our continuous improvement model. And so what we wanted to do was to get an understanding of, are the areas that have started implementing the improvement model, do we see a difference between those who hadn't started using it yet? And so we actually invited a group from Catalysis. So Catalysis used to be the Healthcare Value Network. It's a group consortium of about 70 healthcare organizations in North America that come together and, you know, share best practices and learn from each other. And we've been a part of that. And so one of the benefits of being a member is you get to have an assessment done by people who have been trained in the Shingo assessment model. And so we invited a team to come in and do this assessment at Hillcrest. And they found that there was a difference in the two different areas that we were looking at. But one of the things that they did is in their feedback report, they talked about this concept of key behavioral indicators. And that's the one thing I love about Shingo, is that it used to be tools based. And so when I was at Cleveland Engine Plant 2, we had all the tools in place and we would assess organizations and we'd see that they, you know, did you have error proofing throughout the plant? Did you have a visual management board? But we never really asked, well, how do you use that? tell me about the process that you're using. What are the behaviors that we're looking for? And so Shingo is a behavioral based assessment and they look for key behavioral indicators. And that struck Dr. Hart as being really fascinating. He just really grabbed onto that whole idea. So when I came to Akron, first thing he did was he pulled that report down and he said, this is what I want to do here. And of course, at that time, he didn't know that I was a Shingo examiner. And I said, well, that sounds great. I said, we're going to have some fun. And so working with him, he's been really great at being able to model the behaviors that we want others to do. So in terms of our tiered huddle process, in terms of our daily management system, he's actually taking charts and graphs and making the dots on the daily management thing and connecting the dots and showing everybody else how we're doing at a hospital so that they can see why it's important for them to be doing it on their unit or in their department to track the daily performance to understand, are we getting better? Are we getting worse? Is this a signal or is this just normal variation? Don't overreact. And that's one thing we do in healthcare a lot is we overreact to normal variation and end up doing a lot of work to fix the process that really wasn't broke. We're getting the results that the process was designed to get. But we look for those signals now to say, okay, what can we do to actually move the mean and change that? So so working with him has been great. And over the last 4.5 years, we've slowly, methodically, more of an evolution rather than a revolution, gotten the culture to change to where people now understand and respect the need for looking at things on a daily basis, looking at those process metrics rather than focusing on outcome metrics.
It's interesting. There's a couple of things that I want to pull out of that part of the conversation here. The first is about tools. You know, every time I've read about lean, it's always been about, you know, people, processes, technology, right? In that order. And it's in that order for a reason. But too often people start with the technology or the tools, and then they build processes. And after the processes are built, then they introduce the people to it. And, you know, it doesn't work. I mean, it's a recipe for failure. I mean, you really have to, you know, the people will give you insights that you can't get without speaking with them and engaging them on a meaningful basis. So I really think that, you know, we always have to make sure that when we're doing an improvement, or we're examining an opportunity. So I don't want to say it's a problem because, you know, opportunities can be, you know, so, but, you know, an opportunity for improvement. You know, we have to make sure that the people that are at the pointy end of the stick are involved to share their wisdom, you know, wisdom being, you know, applied knowledge, you know. And the other thing that I pulled out of that was that, culture and time. You know, you talked about it being an evolution, not a revolution. And far too often, people think that they're going to, you know, buy, you know, continuous improvement or operational excellence or whatever you want to call it purple for all I care. But they think that they're going to, you know, push a button, take a pill, or just buy it off the shelf like some SKU and plug it into their business and they're done. And they don't understand that this process takes a long time. And part of it has to do with upskilling existing people. But more often than not, the real challenge is having them unlearn bad habits. You know, so, you know, sometimes it's better to have a green field, you know, where there is nothing, than to have something be introduced to a situation where, you know, the culture has set like cement.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is though, so Akron General as a health system is actually older than the Cleveland Clinic. It's been, it was founded about 20 years before the Cleveland Clinic was started. And so they had a system in place. They, you know, they've grown, and what was interesting is when I first came down there, I was meeting with a gentleman who was responsible for helping with the integration from the Akron General side. And I talked to him and I said, what's been your biggest challenge in doing this? He said, the silos are winning. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, at Akron General, we may not have had the best system, but we had a system and everybody understood how things worked. When the Cleveland Clinic came down, we're an institute-based structure organization. So we've got different institutes for heart and vascular and neurological, different different disease groupings. And each of those institutes kind of operates as its own separate entity within the umbrella of the Cleveland Clinic. But as they were coming down and starting to integrate Akron General, each institute was doing things a little bit differently.
Right.
And so it became very difficult for people there. And the culture, I mean, that was the cultural change that was happening, was
right.
that, you know, we were used to doing things as a system ourselves. And now that system is being broken up into pieces and we're trying to figure out how to put it all back together. And so that's really what we've been doing over the last 4 years is saying, or working on, is how do we get people to understand how this whole, everything works together,
mm-hmm.
and trying to break down those silos. It's very similar to something that happened at Ford when I was, you know, when we were introducing the new engine program at Plant One. Ford had made a decision that each of the different machining lines was going to be standardized. So same vendor, machine builder and everything would be used for every subsequent program that was being put in place. The challenge was that our cylinder head line, the last one, was at the Windsor engine plant. The cylinder block line was, the last one was at the Lima engine plant. And each of the different components were coming from a different plant. I said, that's great. Which visual management system are we going to use? What are the standards that we're going to implement? And they said, well, you know, you have to use the ones. And I said, no, we're going to use the ones that we used in plant two, because the people in plant one are familiar with that. And so we're not going to change it. Well, you can't do that. I said, well, show me where the corporate standard is. And actually found a corporate standard, but nobody had been following it. And so it's the same type of thing. Yeah, when you're siloed and you're trying to bring all those things together, the challenge is in all of those kind of logistics and the mechanics of how do things start to fit together. And somebody's got to change. And
right.
So when that change happens, that's very uncomfortable. And that's why it takes, that culture takes a long time to implement.
Right.
Yeah. I tell people that, you know, lean is actually very simple. I mean, there's nothing complicated about the tools or understanding. I mean, it's pretty simple. It's common sense a lot of times, but trying to change people's behaviors is what's difficult. I use the example of, you know, I go to my doctor and he says, you know, I could stand to lose 20 pounds. And if I did, you know, I'd feel better. I'd live longer. He can show me examples of how other people have done it. I can read about it and do that. You know, show me the data. The rational side of that is pretty easy to explain, but the emotional side is, you know, I got to give up chips. I'd like to. I don't want to do that. Right. And so when you become, you know, it's kind of the, you know, kind of like the enemy of great is good, right?
Right.
But if I feel like I'm good enough, you know, why do I want to do this extra stuff to get me to be great? And so that motivating factor becomes very, very important.
But there's also a point of diminishing return, where the right. juice isn't worth the squeeze. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, do we want to, you know, spend a buck to track a nickel?
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I like to golf, and there's a reason that the hole in the golf course is bigger than the golf ball, because close enough is good enough. You know, I wish mine was like, you know, 3 feet instead of, you know, whatever it is, 5 inches or so. But, you know, we have to deal with what we got. Right.
Yeah.
You know, I want to get back to this tack time, because the way, just share you my behavior, whenever I am going to take a flight or go to a doctor or a dentist, especially a flight, if there's a connection, I want to get the first one in the morning, because
mm-hmm.
they haven't had the opportunity to start, you know, the slinky effect of it, you know, stacking up and getting later and later and later.
Yeah.
So, you know, even with the doctor or the dentist, I want to get like the first appointment in the day, just because I know that they'll take me probably on time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we're thinking about tack time, we know that we're going to see so many patients in a day, but, you know, things happen, you know, especially in the medical, you know, emergencies happen. I was getting a umbilical hernia repaired here in Germany. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had the pre-op, and I'm sitting in pre-op there, and I'm supposed to go into the OR around 10 o'clock or so. And I had to sit there until like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because there was a big auto accident on the A3 on the highway, and a bunch of patients came in and, you know, they had emergencies, and I get bumped. So you have, you know, and I'm not, that's not a complaint, by the way. I mean, I understand sure. that completely. So no issues there. But the thing is, in the medical industry, you know, it's a, for lack of a better term, it's a VUCA existence. You know, there's volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. And you have to work this into, you know, your daily expectation. You know, something's going to go wrong. You don't know what it's going to be, and you don't know when it's going to be, but you know it's eventually going to happen during the course of the day. And so you have to have countermeasures in place, whatever those countermeasures might be, in order to compensate for those injects, those little gremlins that are going to ruin your day. Mm-hmm. And I think it would happen with much more frequency and even with greater impact in healthcare, as far as your daily schedule and your KPIs are concerned, than at a manufacturing plant. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it is. It is, and it isn't. Because if you look at data over a long period of time, you see that there are patterns. There's patterns of people showing up at the emergency room. There's patterns to different types of injuries that occur that might require seeing accidents in the winter, mm-hmm. Versus, you know, something else that's going on in the summer. So there is some predictability, but it's still, like you said, there is still a lot of variation to that. And so yeah. It's like scheduling is a big piece of, you know, how do we handle all of that? And how do you build the right templates for the primary care physician to be able to see all of the types of patients that he needs to see? Mm-hmm. And how do you hold that physician to attack time while at the same time being measured on patient satisfaction?
Right.
So a patient wants to spend as much time as they can with their physician to really, you know, establish that relationship, but he's on the clock, right? Or she's on the clock. They need to, you know, they need to see more patients. And so we try and do things with those primary care specialists in setting up their schedules to accommodate for that. One of the things, another area that we did some stuff with scheduling that was pretty interesting and unique was in our cancer infusion center. There was a lot of wait time. There was a lot. They weren't able to see as many patients as we wanted. So we started looking at the different types of infusions that were being done, and realized that some of them required a lot of extra time for the pharmacy to be able to mix together their medication that's going to be infused. And so by looking at that and just getting those times of when did the patient arrive, how long until they got sat in the chair, how long until they got the first stick, how long did it take for the infusion to take place, and then the follow-up time. By tracking that time, we were able to see that if we moved some of those infusions to earlier in the day, like you said, and then those others later in the day, that we could actually see more patients. And it had a huge impact on our being able to do it. But the challenge, and this is a big difference between, you know, in manufacturing and healthcare. In manufacturing, we had birth histories of parts and engines. So I worked in an engine plant, and we had a birth history that, you know, there was barcoding on every part, or, you know, you could scan every part and you knew exactly when it was made, which tests that it had been through, which ones failed, you know, times and date stamps, so that you could always go back. And if there was a recall, you could always go back and see what engine codes and what model numbers or serial numbers could be recalled. healthcare doesn't have that type of detailed data. And I think that's the thing that we're really start, that's going to be kind of the next thing that happens in healthcare, in my opinion, is that as we start to understand the data more, and we actually, the clinic is working with IBM and Watson and really trying to look at a lot of data to try and help us understand and be able to predict better how things are going to be happening. So it's still a lot of work, standard work. You know, we had things down to the second in manufacturing, healthcare, you know, not so much yet, but we're working on it.
So, you know, no conversation with healthcare would be complete without, you know, bringing up COVID.
Yeah.
You know, March 2020, you know, the world stopped spinning. You know, you had all these processes in place. You had, you know, I know that many hospitals, I had an engagement in, with the hospital network in June of 2020. And that was an elder care network in upstate New York. So, you know, what was happening in elder care, COVID yeah. in New York. So it was a bad situation. But, you know, there are hospitals that were closing down their, you know, wings, you know, entire wings that, you know, for elective surgeries or elective procedures or even cancer treatments to concentrate on COVID. And it struck me because you had all of these healthcare professionals that were quite literally laid off at the same time that there were not enough healthcare professionals. And the whole, there was a lot of things that just didn't make sense. And I'm sure that it's going, the whole event is going to serve many a PhD thesis for decades to come, not just in healthcare, but, you know, across the spectrum from supply chain to whatnot. But what did the, what did you guys do? How did you react? What was the,
So to say that things were disrupted is kind of a, it was a big disruption. So no, we, what was interesting is that, you know, we first, you know, heard about the first cases coming in. And so we immediately put into place a team to start looking at what we needed to do. On our main campus, and so I was not a part of this, but on our main campus, one of the first things that we did was to try and set up a testing site. Nobody knew what to do or how to do this or test for it. And so our labs actually were one of the first ones to come up with a test that mimicked what, you know, the government or the CDC was doing. And we partnered with one of our neighbor healthcare facilities, organizations. We share a building between our two campuses, and it had a parking garage, and we actually set up testing site. And the CI team on main campus was pulled together group. They had 4 days to kind of put this thing together. And what they did is they used the lean tools to say, okay, let's mock this up in a classroom. What's the process going to be? How are we going to do this? Let's time it and see, you know, what supplies do we need? Let's time it, see what works. Let's make adjustments. And they kept focusing on, you know, what's the next big thing that we have to look on. And so they didn't try to tackle it all at once. They kept, you know, they very methodical approach, and they were able to get a testing site up and running within 4 days. And that was right at the very beginning. From a CI standpoint, our team, and we were told, you have to go home. You have to work from home. You can't come into work. We don't want you bringing anything in, and we don't want you taking anything home. And so as a continuous improvement person, we work with people. You know, I was upset because I didn't know how I was going to do my job. What we ended up doing is I worked with putting together a virtual tier three. We have a tiered huddle process at the clinic. And so our tier three huddle, we had been doing this for a while, where we had 60 people gather in a classroom, and from at 9:15, we would talk about all of the things that were going on in the hospital. And we trying to put that up on a wall and look at numbers. And it was a good meeting, but you know, it was still people wanted, we were crowded in a room, we wanted to get out of the room, and so we didn't have really good discussions. When COVID hit and I was sent home, my hospital president said, can we do this virtually? And so I had already had a template set up. We were looking to rearrange the huddle board in our room. So I already had a template set up. It was just a matter of figuring out how do we get all of everybody's information in. So using SharePoint and using Excel, we created a process where people could go in and input their data on an input sheet. I made all the links to the output board, and we would review that output board. And within a week, we had that up and running. Everybody trained. We learned how to use Microsoft Teams, which was interesting because we'd been using another platform, and we had about a week to prepare before we had to leave. So my team was working on learning that other platform. And then as soon as we get sent home, we find out, oh no, we're using Teams now. So we had to relearn all of that. But anyway, we got it going. And within a week we had the meeting going, and it was kind of just as efficient as it was. And, you know, now we continue to do that. We have about 140 people now in that meeting. We talk about twice as much information. Mm-hmm. People feel comfortable speaking when they're not standing in front of 60 people. When you were just talking, they feel more comfortable in being able to speak up. So we've heard a lot more information. So that was probably the good thing that came out of COVID, was it really helped us with our overall communication and daily management process. Mm-hmm. But the clinic itself did some really remarkable things. We have a health education campus, had just opened up, brand new building, in conjunction with Case Western Reserve University. It had just opened up, and we shut it down immediately and transposed it into a hospital. We actually called it Hope Hospital, and it was to accommodate any COVID surge patients that didn't require intensive care but could be treated.
Right.
We had to take out all of the classroom stuff, pipe in oxygen, had all of the beds and everything, and we got that set up within a month. And fortunately, we never had to use it, but it was a good example of how we were able to shepherd resources together.
Right.
and put stuff in place. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's been rough. The various surges have really caused a lot of stress. Our nurses and physicians are burned out. A lot of people are, and so it's been tough from a continuous improvement standpoint to get people's time, their availability to actually work on solving problems, because mm-hmm. they're working on a crisis. And so survival mode causes you to act differently than if you're just in that improvement mode. So,
right. Because it's time it's time to do, not to think. Right. I mean,
right.
Yeah. So yeah, that's electric. So one of the things that, that I wonder about, not just with healthcare and continuous improvement, but just in general, going to the Gemba, all right, to use a lean phrase, you know, seeing the real place, the real deal, in continuous improvement, don't you lose some fidelity by having to work remote and working remote? Or do you take it to a certain level, and if warranted or needed to get the higher level of fidelity, then do you go to see the real place?
Yeah, so probably for the first 6 months of the pandemic, we didn't do any. I mean, doctors and nurses, our leadership team was still there. They were still able to go around and basically just make sure that things are being run. After about 6 months, we were able to kind of resume Gemba visits. And so mm-hmm. once a week, I go with our hospital president, and we go to two or three areas. He carves out an hour a week, and we go and do that. I also do that with our chief nursing officer to go to the nursing units, and our chief operating officer to go to all of the support departments and operations areas. Mm-hmm. And so we were still able to do that. After 6 months, we were able to come in once or twice a week, to do some work like that. And so we were still right. able to start going to the Gemba and see what was going on. And then we would use the time in between to actually work on helping the teams get different things in place from a visual management standpoint, or helping them understand how they might be able to improve a process. So it was challenging, but it wasn't a deal breaker. I mean, we were still able to, and yeah, was it as effective as if we could have been there working hand in hand with them face to face? Maybe not, but it wasn't, right. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. Right. So.
Well, I think that hits the nail on the head. It's not as bad as we think it's going to be, but I think that we can't, especially continuous improvement people, but just in general, I think that we have to make sure that we work in some real live face-to-face time. Yeah. Otherwise, we will become detached. I make the comment that the knowledge worker will become detached from the wrench turner. And, you know, that gulf will only widen. And I think it's really important for both to reach out to the other to make sure we do have an understanding of what's going on at the pointy end of the stick. Yeah. And they understand that we're there to help them and support them be successful.
Yeah. We just reinstated, we call it leadership rounds. And so we used to, once a month, we would bring all of our directors and above and managers together, and we would break up into teams of two or three, and each team would go out to a different unit to talk to patients directly, mm-hmm. To find out what are we doing well and what could we be doing better and just how are we doing overall, and then also talk to caregivers to get their input. Well, that stopped when COVID hit.
Yeah.
Just this past week, we restarted those visits, and it was really refreshing to be able to go in and talk to patients and right. hear from them what's going on and what's happening, and then also to talk to the caregivers because you know they've been just chugging right along and getting sure. things done, and to take that few minutes to sit and talk. What's going on? You know, what problems are you experiencing?
Right.
What can we be doing better? It's very refreshing and very helpful to be able to do that.
Well, Tim, I really appreciate your taking the time and sharing your journey and your experience. The healthcare industry, different but the same, you know, I think that I know that the audience is going to really appreciate the insights in continuous improvement in the healthcare, because I don't think that many of them have actually had the experience or the opportunity to learn about what's going on, behind the curtain, so to speak. So,
yeah, no, it's been a pleasure, and I, like I said, there's a lot of personal satisfaction in healthcare and being able to know that. The work that we do, so at the Cleveland Clinic, we call everybody a caregiver, even those that don't provide direct patient care. And our CEO, our former CEO, was the one who came up with that and said, you know, the work that we do is supporting those who are delivering that bedside care and working with the patients. And so we're caring for them. So we're all caregivers. And that's really an important aspect of what we do at the Cleveland Clinic yeah. is that we think of ourselves as caregivers, and the satisfaction that we get from being able to help a physician be able to do their job better, or to help a nurse finally get rid of that barrier that kept getting in the way of her being able to do her bedside care. It's very rewarding.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Tim, for joining me today. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed the conversation a great deal, and I look forward to the next one.
So. Yeah. No, thanks, Joseph. It's been great. I really appreciate you asking me, and I hope everybody enjoys it.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.